listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with your host, Jay Taylor. If you have a question or comment about today's show, Jay would love to hear from you at 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also send an email to questionsfortaylor@gmail.com. That's questions, the number 4, Taylor@gmail.com. Now, back to our program.
Welcome back to Turning Hard Times into Good Times. I'm your host, Jay Taylor, and I'm really pleased to have with me once again Dmitry Orlov. Dmitry was born and grew up in Leningrad, but has lived in the United States. He moved here in the mid-70s. He has since gone back to Russia, where he is living now. But Dmitry was an eyewitness to the Soviet collapse over several extended visits to his Russian homeland between the 80s and the mid-90s. He is an engineer who has contributed to fields as diverse as high-energy physics and internet security, as well as a leading peak oil theorist. He is the author of Reinventing Collapse, published in 2008, The Soviet Example and American Prospects, and The Five Stages of Collapse, Survivor's Toolkit, and that was in 2013. Welcome, Dmitry, and thank you so much for joining us again.
Great to be on your program again, Jay.
It's really good to hear your voice. I know we had you on back in 2014. It's been a long time, way too long as far as I'm concerned. In that discussion, you talked about the five stages of collapse that you observed in the fall of the USSR. Could you review them, perhaps very quickly, and compare them with what you're seeing and what you have witnessed and observed in the United States as you lived here and, of course, from your post now in Russia?
Yes, the five stages of collapses, I defined them, were financial, commercial, political, social, and cultural. I observed that the first three in Russia were basically the finance collapse because Russia, the Soviet Union, basically ran out of money. Commercial collapse happened because Soviet industry fell apart because it was distributed amongst 15 Soviet socialist republics. And when the Soviet Union fell apart, all of these supply chains broke down. Political collapse, obviously, there wasn't really a functional government at all for a period of time in the 90s. Lots of American consultants running around and privatizing things in a fashion that created a lot of incredibly corrupt, super rich oligarchs that then fled with their money, a lot of them. And then, surprisingly, social and cultural collapse didn't really get very far until Russia started regaining its health. Some of the other Soviet socialist republics are in the throes of full-on social and cultural collapse, but Russia avoided this fate. Now, what's happening in the United States right now is the financial realm has become this incredible Potemkin village. The Americans are running this completely unprecedented experiment where they basically are blowing the hugest financial bubbles they possibly could in just about everything, obviously in finance itself, but also in medicine, in real estate, the stock market, and all of that is directly connected to the printing press. The printing press in the United States now monetizes half of the entire federal spending. And the United States borrows, every year now, borrows twice the amount of money that the federal government earns in a year. So basically, this thing looks like it's gone off the rails and is heading straight into a ravine. But for now, this is just being papered over with this fake printed money. And the big surprise as far as the sequence of collapse stages in the United States is that social and cultural collapse have already happened.
Mm-hmm.
That is, the United States, from a social and cultural perspective, are pretty much 100% defunct. There is no getting back to normal. And so once the financial realm goes and it becomes impossible to continue importing everything that the United States needs, which is just about everything at this point, because the U.S. doesn't really make very much of anything anymore. The other stages of collapse will swiftly follow. And as far as political collapse, well, we have to wait until the November elections to see how that's going to turn out.
Yeah, there's a lot of concern about that here, for sure, about what things might look like. Either way, whoever wins the election, there's concerns about what's going on. That social collapse and lack of seeing things together as a nation is dividing us. It's really nothing like I've seen in my life. Well, Dimitri, you know, since Nixon, you know, since he removed gold from the dollar back in 1971, and by extension, the international monetary system, that allowed the United States then to start printing money, as you pointed out. The U.S. is unprecedented. Modern monetary theory now, I suppose, is in play. That, along with the U.S. military, Kissinger went off and signed a deal with Saudi Arabia, and basically guaranteeing that all the world's oil at that time would be paid for in dollars. And then, you know, when you think about all the countries around the world that have to import oil, that meant that virtually every country in the world needed to find dollars. That put a bid under the dollar and allowed the dollar to be a strong, quote-unquote, strong currency, even though it had nothing backing it. But as you point out, the U.S. is now having to borrow. I think most everything it's borrowing, all of its deficit spending is being financed by printing money, because foreigners are no longer, to the extent they were anyway, buying treasuries. So do you see the possibility of the dollar losing its hegemony and giving way to some other form of currency?
Well, yes, the other forms of currency already exist. Lots of countries are trading using commodity exchanges and currency swaps. So a lot of countries really just don't need the dollar. Iran, for instance, doesn't use the dollar at all to sell its oil, which it does. And it's a major oil producer. Other countries will follow suit. Now, the thing about making the dollar, quote-unquote, attractive really has to do with the ability of Washington to overthrow regimes it doesn't like in various parts of the world, to basically scare everyone into submission. But now, if you look at where the revolts are happening, the more or less successful revolts, well, they're happening in France. They're happening in Bulgaria, which is part of the EU. Huge demonstrations in Berlin, and of course various cities within the United States itself are now basically ablaze, and you know, there's permanent revolt happening in various parts of the world. So this is chickens coming home to roost, and the collective West is no longer an entity that can scare the rest of the world into submission, and that coupled with the fact that, you know, the dollar is being debased at an ever-increasing rate through money printing and deficit financing, basically means that this is going to end very abruptly, the way pyramid schemes generally do, within a single news cycle.
Yeah, it's interesting to note, from my perspective, that China is the largest gold producer now in the world. They don't export any of their gold. They keep it for themselves. Russia is also a very substantial gold producer, and I noticed from what I can see, both countries are building their gold reserves very dramatically. Do you think that is a policy, given their lack of confidence or their view that the dollar's days are numbered?
Well, Russia no longer has any dollar reserves at all.
Mm-hmm.
It's opted for gold. China is getting rid of its U.S. treasuries at an ever-increasing rate. And the plan is to basically have trade conducted not in the dollar, but in the country's own currencies, using various types of currency swap agreements backed by gold. This is how international trade was done before. until the U.S. dollar came off the gold standard, it was basically various currencies, the Mexican silver dollar, things like that, that were backed by metal. So we're back to that scheme, and this is perfectly normal. So we'll be able to look back on this curious interlude from the 70s until 2021, perhaps, look back on it as an aberration.
Yeah, it certainly has been. The idea, of course, with an international gold-backed system, you have a more of an even playing field. In this case, the United States has been able to use its military strength coming out of World War II, and its other advantages that it had at that time to basically dictate to the rest of the world. But we were already living beyond our means to pay for the Vietnam War and the start of socialism in the United States, or say an extension of socialism under President Johnson. We were already living beyond our means, and of course the gold was leaving, and de Gaulle of France won his gold, and he was entitled to it under Bretton Woods. But then we decided that we were the bully, I guess. We were the country that had the power and the ability to dictate to others what to do, and that's what Nixon did, Nixon and Kissinger. And so now, it seems as though we've used our power. I think countries that wouldn't accept the dollar in trade were vulnerable, right? Gaddafi, and before that, in Iraq. So
that's right. But the United States has now run out of countries that it could attack with impunity, that are sufficiently rich to be looted and sufficiently weak so that they could be attacked militarily without huge casualties, huge losses. And the thing about the U.S. military is that it is willing to kill, but it is not willing to die. The United States is completely out of people who are willing to die for other people's money.
Yeah. Well, we saw the turning point, I think, in the Vietnam War when the young people resisted. We've had a pretty good life here in the United States for quite a while, and I guess we've softened up to the point where that's taken place. I would just observe, Dimitri, that historically gold flows to countries that are that are doing well, that are gaining wealth, and it flows away from countries when they're in trouble, when they're running into financial trouble. I think of the USSR, for example, in its closing days and its waning days, was, I believe, using its gold to try to prolong the regime at that point in time. So could you say that things are really definitely improving in Russia? And since you've moved back there now, what are your thoughts about Russia, the Russian economy, and the Chinese economy, both those countries building up their gold reserves? What are things really like in Russia? Because what we hear here, we hear nothing about, except Putin is evil, he's poisoning people that want to compete with him politically, and so on and so forth. But paint a picture of what things are like in Russia now economically, because we're certainly not getting a straight story here.
Well, Russia is a society, a culture that thrives on adversity. It kind of goes along with the huge territory and the harsh climate. But the Russians, they don't do very well when things are fine. But when they're confronted with a situation that they have to do something about, suddenly it turns out that they're incredibly active and incredibly effective. And this is what's been happening. Basically, the 1990s have convinced Russians that things can't go on as they have before. When Putin came to power, he started making changes. And the transformation of Russian society and Russian culture, I would say, has been very thorough. So that, for instance, Russia was notorious for its bad roads. Well, now most of the roads in Russia are basically up to the German Autobahn standard. It used to have really bad cars, but now Russia makes all of its own cars, virtually all of it, and makes lots of cars for export. It's just that the brand names are Western or Japanese or Korean brand names, but they're all made in Russia.
Interesting.
Because of the sanctions regime, has been an absolute blessing to Russia, because it has forced Russia to start making everything that it needed on its own territory. So now it makes its own jet aircraft, for instance. It made itself pretty much immune to those sorts of sanctions. And the latest thing that Russia is doing is basically getting rid of the necessity to export oil and gas, because instead of exporting raw materials, Russia is going to make all of the products, for instance, all of the plastics that it needs. So it will stop importing plastics and will instead of exporting gas, for instance, it'll be exporting plastics and other products made with these resources. Now, this does not bode well for all of the countries in the world that depend on continued Russian raw materials exports. Basically, a lot of industry in Europe is going to shut down, is going to have to shut down because of Russia doing it. But in terms of politics, Russia has a very effective government that is quite popular. The elections that were just held, a lot of, the government candidates from the main party won comfortably. Putin wins with something like 73-75% of the vote. Mm-hmm. The next candidate after Putin is somebody by the name of Zhirinovsky, who's been in politics for a really long time. He's pretty old these days, but he's head of the Liberal Democratic Party. He gets something like 7% of the vote. Why? Because Putin is not enough of a Russian nationalist. Mm-hmm. And then everybody else, including figures like Navalny, which if you read the New York Times, is Russia's premier opposition candidate or something like that. Yeah. Well, he has maybe 2% of the insanity vote, you know. Mm-hmm. Basically, you know, the people who vote for him are people who believe in reptiloids from planet Nibiru and people like that. And then the permanently disgruntled. So there's no hope for him at all. Mm-hmm. But that's the position in Russia now. Russia didn't really suffer from the financial crisis of 2019. It didn't really suffer any great consequences economically from the coronavirus, the fake coronavirus scare. Some measures here were taken, but again, along the lines of thriving in adversity, the need to work from home has in Russia generated a lot of these new arrangements that make it possible to work from home. And it turns out that one of the biggest problems with Russian corporations is that a lot of their staff is in Moscow. Mm-hmm. And so now, because of the coronavirus, a lot of their staff is moving back to Russian provinces where life is cheap and good and places that are uncrowded, mm-hmm. because they can work from there. They can work remotely now. Mm-hmm. So that's a win. Yeah. Some other things that were an absolute win for Russia is when the sanctions, the EU imposed sanctions on Russia in 2014, Russia imposed counter sanctions on food exports from the European Union. And this has given a huge boost to Russia's agricultural producers, so that Russia is now an agricultural superpower. It's the main largest grain exporter in the world. It'll end up feeding half the planet pretty soon. So these are all extreme positives, and Russia is a prosperous and stable country.
And producing their own things, manufacturing again. And this is, of course, what the United States gave up when it decided to do what it did with the dollar and so forth. Well, that's very interesting. And, you know, I mean, another thing I'd like to ask you about, we don't have time, is certainly what Russia would look like post-Putin and all of that, but maybe some other time if we can get you on. Just with a couple minutes left here yet, Dmitry, recently I've heard you talk about the what's going on in America, the demolition of the family, morality. You alluded to it when you talked about social problems that we're having here now. We seem to have, during the USSR, of course, the Christian religion was persecuted, and I think in most totalitarian nations, that's what happens because government.
It wasn't. That's a fake.
That is okay. So you're that was part of the propaganda we were given then. So you're saying that the church, the Orthodox Church, was free to operate during the Soviet days?
It was.
Okay. Well, my impression is that it's alive and well now.
It is definitely alive and well now, doing better than ever. And the thing that people don't appreciate is the fact that Stalin was a seminarian. And as soon as he got the excuse, which was the beginning of World War II, he reopened the churches.
Oh. Well, I mean, that's really news to us here in the U.S., I guess. But in any event, the church is alive and well now. To what extent do you think that is helping Russian society? I mean, you talk about the family, and to me, we've got here Black Lives Matter and Antifa. They're openly against the traditional family of a mother and a father and so forth, and they're openly against the Christian religion here in the United States. So to what extent do you believe that's an important aspect of a society, to have a common view of what is right and what is wrong?
Well, you know, there's it's not just religion. It's kind of it has to do with how nature works, human nature, what is natural. Mm-hmm. And if you ignore nature, then you go extinct. That's how nature deals with it. It's not a problem that any of us have to solve, because Charles Darwin will solve it for us. Mm-hmm. So all of these Antifa types that are anti-family, we'll find they won't be around in another generation. Mm-hmm. They'll just age out and leave no trace.
All right, just one other thing then, before we let you go, because we are basically out of time, but one of the things that you did and you've written about is how to prepare for times when they become difficult. First of all, how do you think the U.S. landscape may look like? I mean, nobody knows for sure, I guess, but just looking and projecting what you see now in the U.S., where you lived until just recently, what do you see for the U.S., and then what should people do? How should we all be preparing to deal with it?
Well, I don't see much hope for anything beyond the county level in the United States. I think cities will be incredibly unsafe. I think it'll all have to do with becoming sufficiently rural and sufficiently self-sufficient in order to ride it out. There won't be much of an official structure to rely on. The more mixed up a community is, you know, there's been a lot of emphasis on integration and inclusion, et cetera. That's not going to be helpful moving forward, because people have to recognize each other. They have to not deal with strangers. They have to avoid having to deal with strangers. So that's going to be a dominant in America moving forward. It'll basically splinter. Society will splinter into small groups, and the only ones that will hold together will be the more cohesive and homogenous ones.
I know in our previous discussion you had suggested that America might split up into different countries, but you're suggesting even smaller political groups than that, the county level.
Yes, I think the county level is about the right level at which politics is not a complete waste of time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. All right. Well, we'll have to leave it go at that, Dimitri. I want to thank you so much for spending your time with us. It's very, very helpful to our listeners, I'm sure. And all the best to you and your family there in Russia. And it's very interesting to hear some things we haven't heard before about Russia. So it's thank you so
much. Well, I'm glad.
Thank you so much. Thank you, Dimitri, for being with us. Well, folks, that is all for this week. Next week, Alistair MacLeod will be with me, and I'll also be speaking with Ian Clausen, the president and CEO of GMV Minerals. Until then, goodbye, and God's blessings to you.
Thank you again for listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with Jay Taylor. Please join us again next Tuesday at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Time, on the Voice America Business Channel.